You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Next thing I'd like to talk about is command and control.
Okay.
I think this is where we get maybe in the biggest trouble. The commander, I tell my headquarters company guys, get them out, that they're really critical, that my ability to command is directly dependent upon their ability to perform their mission. And the comp is the guys that support us, everybody else. And it's key. I think I spend more time on this particular subject, command and control, than anything else. I try to make it a very dynamic thing. My headquarters commandant, my three, my commo, have constantly got to be innovating. They constantly have to come up with new things or new ideas, so I can hit that. And they are. Forever screwing around with the SOP, with the facilities, with the procedures, always seeking to streamline them, make them more effective, everything else. And we learn from every CTX, every MAP exercise, everything we do. In 2 years, I told you we deployed or went on a major exercise 10 times. We went on 20 CTX. Bobby did about 30 MAP exercises. Every week, I require my headquarters company to do what I call command post training. And it's to make sure that they really keep these things unlimbered. The first thing you have to do as a commander is to create the right environment. Now, you see, I got this philosophy that we like garrisons. The garrison closely simulates where we're from, back in East Cupcake. So we're used to lights and showers. We're used to racks with linen and all these things. The abnormal thing is the field. We go there, but we don't like it. I mean, we say we do because we're Marines, but we try to cut it out. We don't do wrong things in the field. And I've got guys who go to the field to pride themselves that they don't take a crap in the time they're out there. You've got to make them do that kind of stuff. I mean, they change their whole routine when they go to the field. They're not used to it. The environment's got to be one of being expeditionary, of being light, of being active, of being oriented and comfortable in the environment out there. The environment you create has to be one like that. My office in the 9th Marines didn't have shit in it. There wasn't a plaque on the wall, there wasn't a goddamn plant in there, or any other crap. I mean, the only good thing, therefore, is to carry your helmet. But I don't think if you have one, you shouldn't have one. I just got a desk. I got a rule that I don't put anything in the drawers of the desk. But then it's like you want to stay there. So I don't read anything. I will go to the ball field now. And still, resident, I didn't read anything, just sign it. Matter of fact, I took 2 weeks leave before I came over here back in 9th Marine, and I was going at the change of command, and Sergeant Mason came up to me and said, "Sir, you got to talk to this new guy." He said, "Remember how you sign everything, even a blank piece of paper, you put it in front of it? This guy reads this stuff." And then I felt kind of bad about it. But I just signed it. If it's screwed up, I'll kill you. I don't spend any time in the office. You get the hell out. Now, how does this relate to command and control? You create the idea that you're going to go to the field, that you want to be in the field, and they're going to be like you. I destroy and put away this. There is not a cop in the 9th Marine Regiment. No one is ever allowed to sleep on a cot. Matter of fact, General Van Riker was the chief of staff of the division. No one in the division is allowed to have a cot. Ever, anywhere. There are no cots. I don't have a tent. I have never slept under a tent in 2 years in a 9th Marine division. I sleep underneath my vehicle. I sleep if we're foot mobile CP mode on the deck next to PFC so-and-so, get crapped in the cat hole next to the PFC and shoot the shit literally about the weather. That's the way your life has got to be as a race master commander. I grew up in a Marine Corps, it wasn't like that. Tent city. I mean, when you went to a regimental CP, you wanted to call Hardeman and Bailey in to be able to tell him that maybe you could move this with your elephant train. And battalions were just as bad. Thank God for changing all that. You've got to be light. And where you pay for streamlining and going light are in these streets of comfort items. I got a rule. We displace at a minimum every 24 hours. I never spend the same night the same place unless I can help. I spent two nights in some places, not because I wanted to, because I got forced into it. But I like to get the hell out and to move and not spend any time than I have it. Mobility is security for command and control facilities. You've got to move. That's critical. And you've got to pay the price in streamlining in these future conferences so you can afford to put it into other things that are more important than the battlefield. You can't go so much here that you can't do the job. And you can't forget, if you're a regiment or a battalion, speaking from that perspective, that you don't go to war as a regiment or a battalion. You go to war as a reinforced regiment or an RLC. Other people come. See, I've seen regiments that say, this is the COC. We developed it on the parade deck, and it's got all my guys. And I go in and I say, when you get back, or when you get engineers, or when you get, you know, other attachments, direct support, where do they go? Oh, out there somewhere in the dark. You know, they're never integrated into the system. It can't be that way. Now, how you set up the facility is important. I got to tell you a little bit about it. Now, let's go back to the sensing of the battlefield, the way I got to do it. My eyes, if they're not on the flight physically, I'm forward, it got to be on the S2's map. Now, my S2 is the key man in my organization. First of all, there's no such thing as an Alpha and Bravo command group below the division level. That's bullshit. You know, you can't do it. You don't have to hear the people. You can do it for a week and take it, just like you don't have to take the practice for a week and be on stage. But you can't exist in two mirror image CPs. I don't care who you are. You can't do it, not in the long term. You have a CP. You can take the command group out of that CP temporarily, and you can go forward with it. You can operate, you can control with it. But that's different from two mirror image CPs. I operate with a command group. It generally stays out forward. I come in occasionally for a lot of different reasons. Camera change over radio operators, give people a break, get freaked up. I might pass control back on my way or whatever. You know, I might take it and move out. But there's this constant flow in and out of the command group from that pick. My sensing of everything has to be eyes on the two map. My hearing is the tac next, higher and lower. Nothing else do I want to hear. Nothing else is allowed to be on a speaker if anything's on a speaker. But I listen to the two next. You know, that's what I want to hear. My fire support coordinator, my ALO, quietly come up and mention that there are calls to fire, or there are things to be arbitrated, at least at my level. My battalion commander, it might have been calls to fire at my level, that he may pick up on calls to fire, or he may pick up on things that two units need some sort of arbitration on. But he's informing me from that point of view. The intel officer tells me of things that are happening that he's picking up, because he has a lot of eyes and ears out there. I described that one thing we did in the course on force with the LAI battalion, bouncing off ones and then going deep. I never talked to the LAI battalion directly through that whole thing. One time after the deception, he swung by my CP on the way out. I never doubted where he was or what he was doing. Without talking to him, we had communication. First of all, he's a good friend of mine. I know him. We think alike. And I knew what he was up to. How did I know where he was and what he was doing? Recon teams reported him. They'll actually have recon teams out and saw him and reported him, which they were supposed to do. I had pre-planned logistics support that was taken out to them by helicopter aviation drops. They reported. You know, I had other things that flew over, airstrikes and things that went on, that reported in sight. That's a form of communication. Knowledge is a form of communication for what he's doing. We have the rule of critical comm. I used to call it desperate comm, but it's like, it sounded too heavy. So it's critical comm. And critical communication means I only need to talk to you if it's something that affects the intent. Something means that I ought to change the intent, you can't accomplish or carry out my intent, the enemy, the terrain, or something else is going to do something to affect the intent, then we need to talk. How we get to talk? Million and one different ways. And we can figure it out. When I was a battalion commander, I controlled all pyrotechnics that went into the air. They all meant something. Company commanders that had to stick those on the ground. But I control the meaning of everything that went into the air. It's a form of communication. It had meaning. I'm in the attack. I secured the objective. You know, so by a series of pyro, one company can understand what another's doing. I'm a believer not in vertical communications, but in lateral communications. I want two battalion commanders to talk to each other through an attack rather than me directing them through an attack, and they're coming up and I'm going down, coming up and going down. See, the science creator comes to me and says, okay, now I know you got so-and-so on right now. What do you want me to do? What do you want him to do? Don't talk to him. Decide what you want to do. Now, you guys talk it out. I'm going to talk a little bit about control methods in a little bit and how I handle that, how it kind of works in this context, too. But then you've got to work it out. Do the lateral communication. I'll monitor, listen, or whatever. I'm not worried about it. I don't need to talk to you. We have these bullshit reports you got to get up. Somebody comes up and tells you, you got a battalion in the attack. Boom, he makes contact with a squad. You know, he takes a couple of casualties, calls in a medevac, and actually kills a couple of guys. I get a report saying, I made contact and killed three guys. Well, no shit. That's what you were supposed to do. Why do I need a report? Why do I need position reports? During the force on force, there was a point in time, and I mentioned this to Sergeant, when I leaned over to my tree, or he leaned over to me, and we were studying the two map intently, because we were trying to figure out what Fourth Marines was and how it was lining up. We were, and I hate to use this term, we were sort of templating, you know, because you know why? ICB works against us. We're so predictable. So I was ICBing him because I knew I was going to operate, and he was falling into place. You know, so I was doing my own intelligence preparation. We had gotten one battalion, we had gotten the CC, and we were getting the other battalion. It was starting to fall in. It was midnight, and Colonel John Rosemore, my three, turned to me and said, you know what, Colonel? Right now, and Glenn Preston, my fire scoreboard that was here, was there next to me. He said, you know, right now, we know more about the exact position of the enemy than we do of our own position. And we kind of all chuckled, you know, around Glenn's coffee pot and said, that's right. Then we started to figure out if that was wrong. That's right. Wrong. That's unbelievable. We know more about the enemy than ourselves. So we talked about that for a while and said, that's okay. We're not doing, I don't need to know where everybody is. They're doing their thing. They're happy. They're going for it. I know where the bad guys are. I mean, life's good. Don't worry. Be happy. And we decided on that. And it was okay. So you have to really structure your command and control and your setting all these things to pick that all up. I generally like to stay away from, it's not that I neglect, but I, let's say, My global CP mode is 4 vehicles. And sometimes more attack security and other things. So we're pretty light in that way. We back it all up, throw canvas over like everybody else does. And we go through the drills and make it clean. But I kind of try to stay away from that, the internal part there. I go in and check on it, and I go forward a lot, do a lot of other things. But I tend not to get in there and insert myself on top of the watch officer and on top of the three and the two. My three really knew me. He knew when I needed to be there, and he called me in. And he knew when, what to tell me. But I'll tell you what, you can get too close to the problem. You can get too involved, too caught up in the day-to-day and the minute-to-minute. You can get so wrapped into the COC that you burn yourself out. I have an obligation to keep myself fresh, and I do that. I stay out, and I rest, and I cat nap, and I screw off, so when they need to dust me off. The doctor called my dream the L-Sid syndrome. I keep telling them, really, I'm dead. The thing is, they dress me up in armor, and they trade me out for sensor. It's really a career to an old guy, Glenn ran the regiment, and they would just dust me off, and they would say that, go get L-Sid, bring him in, dress him up, dress him up. Make the decision to put him away again. Always put him away. You know? But I think that's what the commander's for. And I don't think a commander that kind of runs himself into the deck and gets involved in this sort of shit is going to make it. And you can't do that. You know, that's kind of the environment that you have to set up. I want to talk a little bit about control methods. Organization of the battlefield geometry, which we love. But you see, I was probably a distinguished grad of AWS because I knew how many lines you would bend the op order, and I knew how to draw off, and I could do the symbolic way before your time. Now, as a matter of fact, the guy was a general with the then he made the flag, so we would have reverted back to that process. But you know, I learned to be a draft, you know, really a perfect guy and how to draw the battlefield. I drew the battlefield. I actually began to believe at one time in my life that the battlefield really was the graphics that I drew. People believe that now. Show me a main attack. What does the guy show you?
He shows you this.
The objective, there's the axis of advance, and then there's the tone of action, you know, and that's the main attack. A graphic portrayal is some shit. It doesn't mean anything to you. I hate control measures. Control measures are weaknesses. Every control measure you put down is a self-imposed weakness. A boundary is a weakness. A boundary is a seam. When you put a boundary down, you put a seam down. I learned from the BC, the guys try to probe for your boundaries, find them, and attack along them. Why? Because you stay away from boundaries. If you get close to this sucker, you gotta coordinate with that son of a bitch next to you. I don't want to have to do that. Stay away a little bit. Where do we put them? Known terrain features. Recognizable terrain features. Streams, roads, inclusive or exclusive, if you've been to basic school, you can add two terms. Bridge lines. And these are our boundaries. We begin the box, and we create seams, stitches. Attack the seam. I think the Israelis 73 war, right? Between the 2nd and 3rd Egyptian armies, down the boundary, big gap, room right through. You know, north of the Great Bitter Lake. A seam. I don't use boundaries. Now, I gotta tell you the honest truth. The little suckers split the middle on me. They don't think I know. Right, Ken? I mean, I know the battalion commanders get all nervous and they create about, they have an agreement between each other. And they'll tell the fire support coordinator so he won't kill them. But you know, I don't like it. And they always say to me, sir, how can you operate without a boundary? It's gotta have a boundary. I say boundary causes vertical thinking. Boundaries mean, okay, because the colonel's still alive, my right flank is secure. So now, think forward and talk to the colonel and go. But don't talk to the other battalion or the other company. There's no need because there's a boundary. Hoping that the guy out there on the other team understands that rule that we've just established by the Marcus Queensburg. Don't screw it, you've got a boundary here. I'm protected. You know what happens when you have no boundary? They got to talk to each other. They hate it. They got to cooperate, coordinate. And they don't like it. And I love it because it's less work for me. Now it's the lateral communication and it's vertical shit up and down. But I don't like houses. I don't like too many fire support control methods either. I got something I want to offer all of you school presidents, deans, and whatever you are. When you get to new class, one of your test questions. Ask kids that we have two types of fire support control methods. Permissive and restrictive, right? I say that right, you already got it. All right. Now, let's take one of those permissive stuff. Coordinated fire alarm, right? CFL. We all know, because we're graduates here, that that's a permissive measure, that that means you don't have to coordinate the shit if you shoot, you know, surface indirect fires beyond it, right? Ask all the new guys what a coordinated fire line is. You know what they'll tell you in most cases? A coordinated fire line is something you have out there, and if you shoot short of it, you got to call the guy up and coordinate with him, talk to him. In other words, they put it in restrictive terms, same with the fire support control method. They put it out there to protect themselves. It's another scene. It's another protective method. It's another thing out there that they put in. Run a MAC exercise with CPX with no boundaries and no fire support control method. Try it. No objections. Clean mats. I mean, you're going to cause some high anxiety to begin with. But watch what happens after you do it. It's amazing how much communication, cooperation, coordination increases and how effective you become. You know, I defy them to do it. I've done it. They hate it. In the end, they love it. They're proud of it. We did this with no boundaries. A regiment with no boundaries. The last time, five numerals. No boundaries. I know sometimes they're stuck in them. They got a little worried, nervous, and the screen made a deal, cut a deal with the time, they didn't tell them, don't tell us, they got to fucking go. But I'll buy that. You know, there are times when you're going to force me into that stuff. But try it sometimes. Get away from the battlefield geometry. And don't ever, if you're a commander, look at the three stack. It's the world according to Bart. It's not the way it really is. I want to talk about another trap we run into. Phasing. As soon as we get into an operation, the first thing we do. Phase line Red, phase line Blue, phase line Sally, phase line Mary, you know, all phase line Ohio, you line them up. Phase 1, phase 2, phase 3. Phases of offensive combat. Phases, phases, phases.
We phase ourselves to death. They have no meaning. We have some natural phase, day to night kinds of death. We change everything. And dark stops. And truth stands out. You know? We change names of things in God. I was on a final coordination line at the basic school. It got dark. I was on a final line at the point. I don't understand what people say on the golf course. You have to change your name because it got dark. And it's like when it takes you back again. I don't understand. And then it gets dark, we do things differently. At each point, you know, guys, all this shit, we're going through this stuff. And when we change from night to day, we face. We eat three times a day or two. Basically, I can tell what Americans eat. But generally, in the morning or sometime late in the evening, we're going to have a short meal here around noon time, right? Now, think about this if you're the enemy. I have phases of offensive comments. Phases lead to expectations. When I described that sequence I went through in basic school, where I went from the assembly area to the objective. Now, your last work in the United States Marine Corps rifle. You have just reached the objective. You have gone into the third phase of offensive combat. When I was a lieutenant, it was make, move into contact, attack, consolidation, with the next one takes. Now I guess it's attack, right? Preparation for the attack, consolidation, with the set in order. You guys, it's like still like mount, mobile combat, the built up area, fighting the tall buildings. I don't know what it is. Once he parks his butt on that hill, the objective, and he's pursuing by fire, spray and pray. What do you think the expectation is for that man of course? The expectation is, he ain't going to have to get up and go forward. It's rest time. It's gunny with the chow. It ain't gunny with the chow in real combat. We don't, the bad guy doesn't give us the space. It's a trap. You know, the sustainment routine can become a problem. The tactical phasing that I just described can become a problem. It leads to expectations. It leads to predictability. Get away from these phases. What a phase truly is, when you don't have a clear picture as to how to get to the center of gravity, when you don't have a clear picture how to fully carry out your intent, you express it, and you're going to get to it, but it is in your mind, in time and space, a ways away. You've got a clear picture of the immediate. Then your phase. Phase one is my clear picture. In my clear picture, my first time ashore, period, I will get a clear picture of phase two. It's a clearing, evolving picture. Give me an example. Let's say I'm going to land. This is a fort down here. I'm going to land up here in this beach, come down, and grab this fort. There's some bad guys down here. Now, I'm a pretty good distance away. This bad guy is good pressure on this fort. His other bad guys are strung out in this direction. I'm landing behind him. I look at this situation and say, you know, with this line of communication is critical. Center of gravity. He can be reinforced, he can withdraw. He wants to maintain that. If my pressure is threatened, if in time and space I affect this thing, that's what's going to cause him to take the pressure off this, either move back, or have to face and deal with this. But from up here, at sea, my little boat, that is way far away. I know where I want to be and what I want to do. The when and now I'm clear. Phase one might be the establishment of that short beachhead line. Getting ashore, getting on limber, getting out to where I'm balanced and I'm prepared to move south. That's phase one. From that phase one, I can't see this yet. Maybe in the second phase, it will be a better orientation and a movement that will get me in line, that will develop the disposition to the enemy, that will allow me to begin the movement and the deployment. And then in that final phase, I will realize. See, in time and space, and in the clearing picture, the phasing is really in the mind of the commander, and how he sees the evolution toward his intent. It is not a daytime thing, a reporting thing, and that sort of stuff. Phasing becomes an attempt to synchronize, which is not good. You know, it stifles initiative. It pulls back on people that can go, that have momentum. Phasing is restrictive. Even if you say, just report at the phase line. The mental picture is we got to all be along the phase line. You know, and if you don't have communications, what does he do? So phasing is a dangerous thing. It's automatic. It's one of those things that were built in that we got to watch. It doesn't work. You have to create your organization a sense of mental and physical action. Anytime I see somebody heat up an MRE, I displace the CT. But then I know we've been there too long. Anytime a guy breaks out a heat tab or he dicks with it, you know, he takes this MRE, and he's going to combine them in accordance with the McElhaney little cookbook he had, it's time to move. You know, we've been there too long. We don't do that stuff. And the idea is this agility, the ability to react. I want to follow up with something very, very important. A very important distinction. Tempo is controlling the pace of battle. Decisions like whether to give battle or refuse battle. Cause, you know, generate the action, cause reaction, get inside the OODA loop, you be the actor or he has to be the reactor. Dangerous little thing you got to watch here. Never confuse activity with tempo. Never confuse speed necessarily with tempo. Never confuse the fact that you do more things with you being more relevant on the battlefield. Vietnam's a classic example. The more active force was the U.S. We were more active, we did more things. It was useless activity that expended useless energy. It did not control the tempo. The guy decided what he wanted to fight. An analogy for you. You've all seen boxing matches where the little guy comes out, all high speed geared to go, and for the first five rounds throws 138 punches, the other guy's two, and then, ba-boom, he's on the deck, right? He never controlled the tempo. He was more active with a lot of irrelevant activity. Irrelevant activity means doing things for the sake of doing things. We did that in Vietnam. Irrelevant activity means taking irrelevant vulnerabilities and counting them. The little Bomber in Vietnam was easy to kill. He was easy to kill. We liked that he was easy to kill. Sometimes he wasn't even the bad guy. He just killed somebody. Get his little grenade down, make him a bad guy, you know? And so we counted him. This was fun. The baggy little sucker's like dumb people with no restrictions, you know? That was a vulnerability, in that he was easy to kill. It was an irrelevant vulnerability, and he expended a lot of energy chasing that vulnerability. Catch the body. Shoot him. I was assigned to dig up graves. Now he's crazy. Maybe you guys count him. Oh, that's too hard for the head. Be fun. So that's the way we had to go about the idea of war. Facing an irrelevant vulnerability at an activity level that that doesn't. Those of us in Vietnam can tell you about endless sneaks that we conducted. Nobody was there except booby traps. We swept. We did it. At the end, you remember how they talk about how good morning Vietnam was it? The radio would come on, the guy would say, the U.S. Air destroyed 80 miles of trench line today. Oh, shit. Who what? Huh? 80 miles of trench line. We destroyed an irrelevant activity. We felt like we were in control of what we were doing that shit. And you gotta watch that, because that's when your energy level goes down. Maneuver versus firepower. Why versus? Because we have created a mindset, gentlemen, that these two things are in competition. I know you didn't intend to do it, but as soon as you said these two, or the implication was made, or we drew the inference that these are competing, you made them fight each other. As soon as you make the implication that one was subordinate to the other, which is bullshit, firepower is nobody's candidate. I don't give a shit about that. I like firepower. It kills. It's macho. It's steel on target. You know what's happening out there? I want to tell you. We're teaching our people to kill people with people when they don't have to. I say kill people with things, not people. The lieutenant, the captain, will move against an enemy when he could kill him. Read Rommel. Rommel said, as soon as you get hit, plaster the bastard with fire. First thing you do, plaster him with fire. Fire and movement. Maneuver and firepower are complements. They're meant to be integrated. Don't get hung up. It's the same mind game like deciding on LD and LOD, trying to decide which one's subordinate to the other. There are times when you will kill with firepower. Maneuver will set it up. There are times when you will kill with maneuver and firepower will set it up. We had fireplaces in Vietnam. We laid in a series of ambushes, we blew the shit out of the mangrove trees, flushed the little bad guys out, and then killed them there. Firepowered, pushed them into the maneuver elements, and we killed them that way. There were times when we let them in to attack. I shot a 714-round COT one time on a bunch of bad guys. They got sucked in, but they found the gap. No shit, you found the gap, man. 714 rounds on your ass, you know? Firepower, get it. Maneuver, take them out, let them into it. Got to teach these lieutenants how to integrate. I was on a board today where we didn't think about this. Climb the hill and knock the guy off. Why? Smoke him and ATM and go around. Now, again, we got the North Koreans during the first parts of the Korean War when they came down to the Busan perimeter. Look how they handled the army. The army popped itself with everything to high ground. They just blowed around them. Tank fire, artillery, and everything, suppressive, pinned them down, and they just blowed around them, blowed around them, all the way down. Low ground. Now you're low ground. Recon versus security. Worst thing I can hear is security screen or recon screen. Recon does not screen. Screening is security. Security orients on the good guys. Reconnaissance and intelligence collection orients on the bad guys. I know people that say, I've got my eyes and ears out because I'm surrounded by reconnaissance units, reconnaissance patrols, and sensor strength. Your eyes aren't out. You're secure, you're protected, we're in a hole. None of that shit's oriented on the enemy, it's all oriented on you. I know people that put sensor strings in on their pipe, and then the tube controls. If I put a sensor string on my pipe for security, that's a screen obligation to worry about that sensor string, not the tubes. That's not intelligence collection, that's security. There's a difference. So, on what you're orienting on, if you're going to go after the bad guy with your intelligence collection, you need to go after the bad guy. If you're going to use those assets for your own security, don't deceive yourself that it's collecting intelligence. It'll tell you when doomsday is coming, that's for sure. You've been penetrated, and it's coming pretty fast, but don't confuse these two. I teach a class on all this shit, and on how to saturate areas of intelligence collection assets. I get a lot of questions from lieutenants like, sir, if you have to clear, if you have to do a route of reconnaissance, if you have to clear a road, how do you do it? If you have to go into an area, like a jungle area or something like that, you're not sure where the enemy is, how do you seek them out? What's your pattern? I teach sector boarding, crisscrossing, cross-train patrolling, all those sorts of things that are means of taking an area, dissecting it, picking it up, and finding out what's in there. Now, and it's a whole set of techniques to be picked up, part of the battlefield skills. In the security part of this thing, you need to protect your own vulnerabilities. Your own centers of gravity, your own lines, your own resources. I want to talk a little bit about the reserve. We designate a reserve. I don't like the term reserve, since we're into a changing term. Reserve is like a cooking. Reserve two egg yolks, you know, holding them back. The term reserve implies holding them back. I don't like it. I don't like the idea of pink reserves. I think that's bullshit. That violates everything we've heard today. I rarely use a reserve. My reserves are deployed laterally. Not vertically. I should think about that. If I think I got a reserve, because you're goddamn American, you have a reserve somewhere. Really don't, doctor. You deploy laterally. So if I see four battalions, you really got five. No, I got four. You hit two, the other two will become the reserve. And they'll come at you laterally, not vertically. You know? Think about that for a while. I don't decide on the reserve. Now the missions for the reserve. I want you to take all the missions that we write about. They all reinforce failure. If you assign a reserve for rear area security, that reinforces failure. What failure? Rear area security. If you assign a reserve to be prepared to carry out the mission of one of your maneuver elements, what fails? That maneuver element's accomplishing its mission. That's a failure mission. You know? You have to have an anticipated use of this reserve. You have to see it. I got a question for you. The reserve, the force of opportunity, so valuable, the key, the thing that drives it home. When it's committed, is it the main effort? Should it only be committed as part of the main effort? If you commit it to less, what's the point? Think about that. Every time the reserve is committed, should it be the main effort? Should it be part of the main effort? Should it be part of bringing the main effort home? If not, you've got to think about what the hell you're doing with that reserve. And why you have it. Think about committing the reserve first. I don't buy it to a ticket. He who commits the reserve last wins. I like first. I make my guys give me examples of when you commit the reserve first. They're pretty good. Boy, on the attack. You know, in the defense, attack. I just gave an example. We were in Germany where we attacked in the defense. You know why? Throw it in there. What about if it's an amphibious operation? You got a reserve helicopter for it. You're worried. There's a goddamn enemy reserve running around out here. I know where it is. Like fix it. Like pin it. If I knew where it was, I'd get it. Once we get a story start moving, you find it too, I want to send the reserve right in and fix it. That's the center of gravity. I want to hit it. Well, he comes in the night before the landing, he says, we found it. It's here. Commit the reserve tonight. Before HL ran out. I got a trigger finger on the reserve. I got to admit. Now, that flies in the face of everything I know you guys read about, know I'm a trigger finger with the reserve. It's uncharacteristic of Americans. And I tell you what, it screws people up. I also like to create imaginary maneuver elements. I had a fake maneuver element to force on force. Took some tanks and Amtrak, some engineers and shit, and created a pretend battalion. You know, and these things are great running around. But people try to count. See, they ITV you. You know, they count your maneuver elements. That's got to be a maneuver element. It's running around on its own, it's up here, and you take them out. I think we need to be a little bit more imaginative with this idea of the reserve and how it's used and where it's employed. And I don't think we should think vertically about reserves. We need to think laterally. Risk. We talk a lot about risk. And we say we've got to take risks. But one thing we fail to talk about is how do you judge the degree of risk you're taking. That's something to teach the officers here at Quantico. This is risky. You know what my question is? How risky? Am I going to lose the whole enchilada? Or is there a danger that I'm going to get my ass kicked and have to give up 3 clicks? What is the risk? We don't teach people to measure the degree of risk. Why do I risk somewhere? Measure the degree of risk. If I do this, I can lose the whole campaign. If I do that, I might lose the force. If I do this, I might lose the battle. You know, but measure the risk you're taking. You're more confident in taking the risk if you sort of have a little feel, a little instinct about exactly what you're risking in the worst case. Measuring risk is going to lead and determine the degree to a better acceptance. The last point, and we never thought we'd get there, I want to talk about, is something called battlefield adjustment. The mark of a truly great military force is the ability to adjust on the battlefield. To tactics that are now required that you didn't anticipate. The new techniques, the weapons. Example. I read Iwo Jima. Go back to that. Right before Iwo Jima, after Tarawa and Peleliu, the Marines said our organization is screwed up. So right between, in between battles, they reorganized the Marine Rifle Platoon. Two squads as we know them now, with fire teams as we kind of know them now, except they were three men, so four men. But they formed a fourth squad. This squad is composed of two demo teams, two flamethrowers, and two BARs. BARs covered and suppressed, flames went up, you know, burn everybody, push them back, and then they blew them up. The old blind and burn of glass kind of concept. That was this innovation for the islands that had caves and bunkers and adjustments. Rama with his 88, a battlefield adjustment using the weapon system as it was anticipated. The technique, force crew tactics in the Battle of Okinawa. I love it. You know why I love this one? Because the tank is so crazy. You know, the tankers are, I was going to be a new runner. They took one tank, one engineer squad, one infantry squad, formed it into a team, and the infantry corporal commanded the tank. I loved it. Worst thing we ever did was get rid of the infantry home on the tank. That's the worst thing we ever did. I'm telling you, tank infantry tactics are not dead. We parked our tanks in Vietnam. Read how the Australians use their tanks in Vietnam. I will recommend a book to all you in basic school called In Good Company. It's written by an Australian who was a platoon commander in Vietnam. He's now a lieutenant colonel. It's the greatest book I've ever read about small unit tactics operations, small unit leadership, small unit leaders thinking. It's phenomenal. And they talk about how they use armor in the jungle. You know, and the basic value of tank infantry tactics. We should get it. When I was a captain, we did it. You know, we cooperated with tanks. Now I can't. I get whisked along in the back of this APC. You know? And let me tell you how tankers do it. You made all these tankers move around with players, and they want to have it, they turn to the infantry guy and say, as soon as you dismount, you're on your own, Jack. You know? You got it. I'm over here. You're there. If you think there's cooperation, it's a 29-5 mentality. So we got to be careful with all that. There's the use of armor in the Philippines. I really thought the time I was down there. But it isn't going to be with the kind of mentality I have now. Again, it's because I don't see Windows syndrome and the failure to adjust. You got to adjust to the environment and to the enemy. What he gives you and what he does. If you can't make the adjustment, you're doomed. There's going to be many more days on the phone and the kind of civil war tactics you have. All right. I'm done. 3 hours instead of two. If you got some questions, comments, I'd be glad to take it.
Sir.
Every operation. My guys made me do it. And sometimes, I want to tell you something, I was stretching. There wasn't enough there to really come up with one that I was confident in. But I had to have one. Because you have to have a focus. You have to have something you're aiming at. So it had to change then eventually, or it had to clear up and become more defined. But I had to have something to grasp onto. And I had to have one thing. My guys would try a lot of times say, there really isn't one here, Colonel. And I say, no, we're going to make one. We're going to make one. We're going to have a focus. And if it isn't right, it'll get us into the fight, and we'll clear it more, or we'll change it. Sometimes it considers a lot of us, three of them actually, let's go after all three. No, we're going after one. And we're going to focus on one. We did. And that led to a lot of interesting discussions. Not all the time as I confident, but a lot of times people are pretty hokey. Well, absolutely, because I don't think you can express intent without having an object for your intent. The object has to be the center of gravity and what you want to have happen to it. You don't like the term center of gravity, if we're going to create a new term, it's going to be critical capability, you know, whatever you want, I don't know, you call it again, you know, Jewish, Chevy, whatever. It's there, you want it, it's a thing, it's something, you know, and I don't mean a physical thing, but there is something to latch this intent onto, to anchor it to. Or else, how can you have an intent without an objective? How can you have an objective without an idea of something you're after and you want to disrupt, dislodge, break the cohesion of, destroy, neutralize, suppress, or whatever?
Yeah. As far as vulnerabilities, you didn't always, those weren't always obvious in the
no.
That's
right. That's right. And you're looking for the vulnerabilities and you're looking for the relevant ones. Again, you know, that's something you got to sense. Relevant to the intent. And of course, we're gearing you eventually to the center of gravity.
Sure. I'd like to ask three specific issues you're using, your comments on these and how you use them. The STSML, the staff planning sequence, and the FTD, which you've already talked about.
All right. Let's take the first one. I'm a big believer in the estimate of situations. I think if you master the estimate of situations, you understand it, you truly can draw, you can truly do an analysis of the mission, you can truly understand the enemy, draw the center of gravity, look at the vulnerability, understand the value of terrain, the appreciation, use the environment, all those things, imaginative, the true essence of the art of commandership, develop combat power, generate, maximize mobility, all those things you do as a commander in the decision, those are the results of the proper estimate of the situation. The true quality of a commander is the ability to do the estimate. I don't give a shit if it's a squadron. The kid that all of a sudden is on patrol and bam, bam, two shots, he's down. They execute a contact right, and he's now got to decide, do I break contact? Do I go into him? Do I call for fire? He's going through an estimate. And you can met CSNL training, all right? You may not like it because it's supposed to listen to an acronym. But it's still, you find something better, fine. It'll still have the same components to it. It's automatic. Let's go through the staff planning process. The rapid planning process with the new stock. I fell in love with that. I got my own. It isn't the one that uses the LFTC, but I don't like it. You know, I developed my own, and I use it all the time, even in the conventional lots. Because it's fast, it's quick, it gets things done. It relies on a couple of key things. One is integration with staff, not later steps. You know, we can go through it. It relies on quick, short breaks. It relies on quick decision points. You know, it's done very quickly, and it shortcuts the system, but still manages to get in the critical things, and reduces time tremendously. It's an efficient way to do business, and it doesn't leave anything out. Let's talk about time, planning time, which is the true crux of the matter here. If I got 12 hours, why not use 12 hours?
Why not yoke my staff and my subordinate commanders everything they got? Why not bring out every idea? Why not go through every fine detail I can to ensure the operation is going to be a success? Now, if I've got 12 minutes, then I'm just going to say, go. I want to tell you a story. We had a guy stand up here last night and said, the Royal Marines, you know, and the SAS and all this stuff. I had a company when I was the 1st Battalion, 8th Marine. We went to the Caribbean, and I was given a Royal Marine Commander, one of their battalions, or the deployment. And there was one of their companies came to 1A. Now, this is right after the Vietnam War. All my NCOs were Vietnam vets. You know, we were on this exercise. We landed in Vietnam. That was on the HMS Bulwark. We had beer and rum, and this was great. We loved it. We boomed ashore. In the middle of this exercise, the CO, the commando, calls me up and tells me, we've got a little change of plans here. We want you, instead of doing this, to do that. Got it. Boom, moved out. Next thing I know, his little Wessex comes flying over me and drops me in. Stops. Comes down, he says, come aside. He says, I've got a question for you. What are you doing? Hey, you told me to change the scheme, go from here to here. I'm gone, you know. Instead of being on the sweep, I'm going to be in the box and move down here. How can you do this so fast? Maybe I can do it so fast. Because I'm waiting for my guys, I'm going to do this, this, and that, over here. No, you've got to go through an order group first. And we've got to have a glass of wine, you know. Hey. One more rum and beer, I might get sick. So, yeah. I want to give you another C story, because I think it's important to go back to SNEAC and stuff today. I was talking to commander of Vietnam first came in. I gave an order to my platoon command. They went out and gave an okay order. Squad leaders were out there. We were in a landing zone ready to be picked up. They had a lot of time. They're going to be there about an hour. And they had plenty of time to give the order. I went around and I was listening to these orders. They were terrible. They were rambling, disjointed. I listened to the platoon commander give an order. And the guy saying, so let's go back and talk about Chow and Ammo again, how that's going to happen and all this stuff. You know, I finally called the platoon commander back and I said, this is the rule. SMEAC, 5 paragraph 40, got the laminated cards, you're going to use it from now on. You got it? All the squad is going to use it. Ah, sir, you know, shit. Use them. Well, now what I started to see is they broke out the cards. They didn't write anything. They just went through it in a sequence. I saw platoon guys waiting for admin logistics, knew when he was going to get his little load. Nothing was left out, you know, pyro signals or anything. A good little procedure, quick, efficient, nothing left out, no one might intended me to go up. It planned, it was good, it went. I made all my squad leaders do fire plan sketches when we stopped. Why? Because it forced them now to pay attention to what the hell was around them and out in front of them. First time I asked a fire plan sketch, this one guy came back, he was an artist, he drew a picture. These things, these techniques, a lot of them, let's examine carefully now, are valuable. They cause efficiency. If they cause the degradation of effectiveness, that's a problem. If they don't reflect reality, that's a problem. They need to be canned. If they are effective and efficient, we need the technique and the procedure and need to put it in. If you become, you know, if you become a victim of that thing and it drives you and it becomes an end to itself, then that's wrong. That's the personality function. Remember the first thing I passed up here was the commander of the time. The personality, the driver, the force. If he isn't that strong a personality, he becomes a victim and subordinates himself to a process and procedure, same on him, stick to him, you know? A Marine, a Ruga, you know what he does, yes? Now, the last one, I don't believe in it. I don't like, for the same reasons Bill talked about, I don't believe in templating anything. I don't believe the bad guy is going to give me that. You know, I don't really get into that kind of template. I mentioned doing it once because they were Americans and they were predicting. But I would never trust anybody to say, I didn't let my shoes do that. We didn't template the shit. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, I want to ask you, you know, you like to turn center of gravity and get a big debate on that. And how other countries tend to get that bag because of their problems. But it causes me to raise the question, when you use center of gravity, what does it mean to you, other than saying center of gravity? Well, in other words, obviously it's related to your opponent and what you're going to do. So what does it mean to you, the man, to say, we're going to have that center of gravity?
It is something that I can, that if I can, disrupted, it will lead to his unraveling, his destruction, the breaking of his cohesion, his defeat.
Okay, then in essence what you're saying, in that sense, then it represents some kind of a critical capability which unravels. Is that correct?
Yeah, by definition, it would have to be critical or it wouldn't unravel if we could defeat one.
Yeah, in a sense, we're talking about a critical capability.
Yeah.
Am I right? If I'm saying it wrong.
It might not be a capability. You might, in fact, be a vulnerability. Why not? And it will lead to his destruction and disruption. It's a vulnerability. Let's take the Army of Northern Virginia, if you will. And let's, for the sake of argument, say that maybe their center of gravity was Richmond, because they were tied at an umbilical cord at that time. Keep threatening Richmond, you're forced to suffer in front of you, and you can keep fighting, and then apply a Christian warfare because you're less talented force and beat him. Now, you may argue with the analysis of that. My history may be all screwed up. But was this been a capability, or was it a vulnerability? Well, why could that? That's another head game. You know,
that's just a vulnerability. It's a critical vulnerability.
Okay. Critical, I don't have any problem with critical. Yeah, by definition.
Right, yeah, that's what I'm saying. Either a critical capability or a critical vulnerability or something. I don't know. I just unravel it. A critical something.
Who cares?
Who cares?
Right. Exactly.
And I think that's the key word. You've got to make sure that it's something critical that's going to cause him enormous problems so you can realize his purpose and he cannot. We pull him apart.
Yeah.
And the reason why we've been through this is we've had a huge debate on it for a long time. And one of the reasons why the way the Bible is defined is it's all fucked up. Read it. It's all fucked up. The other point I wanted to read on this one with you. Unless somebody else has a question, and I don't want to break too much of your question. You talked about boundaries, which, of course, comes to Bobby's very small study, but I think the human life operates in 10 or 20 years, or it's not a divorce. Well, I agree with you. And I like to comment without boundaries, I think this is the key point you made. When you remove boundaries, you force this lateral cooperation so people have to work together. When you put boundaries in, that's important.
Yeah. And the lateral cooperation may lead them to saying, sir, we absolutely need the boundary. And I would give it to them then.
Yeah, I understand.
But see, by me not imposing it initially, it leads them to the cooperation which may lead to it, and it can be justified.
You see, I think that's the key issue. The fact that without the boundaries, you force a cooperation that otherwise wouldn't be there.
That's right.
And that's the issue. That's why I love it. Beautiful idea. And the other point you make about phase points and all that kind of stuff, that's another boundary or hindrance and that kind of stuff. Now, you and I have discussed earlier about culminating points, but culminating points also can be what I call self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah.
Now, in some cases, like you come back and you came back to me very hard about fuel, you may only be able to go so far as you can understand it. But in many cases that people do, they also say, well, we're only going to be able to go so far as the end of the fuel, and they come up with something about the fuel to be entire and all that stuff. You don't know that at that point. And in that case, you can't recognize that until it occurs, or in record that you should have used that know when it's about to happen. But to try to predict that ahead of time is very difficult.
Yeah, let me go back. Let me go back to these instincts and this sensing of things. There's an implication of what you say, that this guy knows his own culmination point, or he's created, or it's imaginary, or it's self-fulfilling. I'm talking about the commander knowing the culminating point of his subordinate units. I have a feel for it. Let me tell you a little story about the force-on-force exercise. I, at the time, was in the fight for 48 straight hours. And I don't mean just in the fight. I mean in the thick of it. By their own choosing, chose to fight for 48 straight hours. At the end of 48 hours, I called the county commander in. I said, break contact. Go to these coordinates. You're in an assembly area. You're in reserve. It wasn't really in reserve. And go to sleep, because I'm not going to use it. And he said to me, well, I don't want to do that. And I said, that's an order, you're going to do it. And then he turned to me and said, thank you, we needed that. And then he did. And he went off, and I put him down in the back for 12 hours. I know the culminating point, and I know where it is, and I don't ever want him to reach it. Even if he doesn't. And I, you know, and so I got to keep tuned to that subordinate. Remember I said, I bring my four with me to visit the time, not my three. There's a reason for that. But my context of using culminating point is more famous, you know, than it is in an operational or moral sense. And a little bit it is, but more in a sense. Mike? Okay.
Yeah, so, I really want to bring you before the evening's over, every time I listen to your pitch, it gets richer and it gets better, and I believe and whenever I hear it, I feel good about the way things are going. And of course, I watched Noise Marines operate over on Okinawa, and indeed, you know, the stuff that Tony's talking about was taking place. And I talked to these lieutenants, nowhere close to their regimental commander. I lived with someone in the field, and the drill that they were being put through on the center of gravity was making them think like no lieutenant had thought. And my point is, I don't want me or anyone to get carried away with the euphoria, because this isn't happening throughout the Corps. And you know, if that man from Mars that we've talked about would appear and be here tonight, he'd say, well, the new Corps is really ready and raring to go. However, I went out on Colonel Bliss, and I I've seen a lot of other regiments and battalions, and you know, the lessons, of course, you picked up, because I talked to you a lot, I know, I would say most of them come right out of their experience in Vietnam. I mean, they really do, and so do I. And that's why I get so intense about these things, is because these ideas come out of Vietnam. You know, the boundaries didn't work, so much of what we've been taught didn't. It's so much is relevant. Well, what I'm asking, and maybe you've got an idea here. And I don't want to think too much on Colonel Bliss, because that was the most thing I've signed up with. I start to invent the area, and he certainly understood. You know, the kinds of things you're saying, and yet when you went down in the field, you saw business as usual. And our task is to fix the thing, and I'd just like to hear your idea about where we can go from here, so that we have a Marine Corps that's thinking creatively and is willing to put aside the things that didn't work, and this machine seems to go on, no matter what we do. And it stands out that there are objectives, and I know that there are a few objectives. Well, the helicopter clock operations, you know, we've talked about them, and the lab's not in there yet. Yeah, I'm convinced unless we change our modus operandi somewhere, so they're going to be going on 6 months from now, and yes, regardless of all those things, words you said. And, you know, what's happening in Ninth Marines now? I know Mike Strickland, they came out of the picture. I don't want to talk personalities. Mike Strickland is a great guy. But the thing is, any one of us, can take over a regiment or a battalion and do wonderful things with it, and then we leave, and it comes back. And just to what it was. And I really think that it's an important question that I'd like to ask your views on. How can we get this stuff to grip?
Let me make one other point, because it leads into this and it's important. I've heard a lot of talk about unit cohesion. I don't agree with the concept of unit cohesion as I see it. Somebody tells me, I need to have my battalion replace that with company squad together for 5 years, and that's unit cohesion, and we'll be great, we'll go on the battlefield, we'll do well. 2 days after you're in a battlefield, you can't got cohesion anymore. You know, what happens on the battlefield? What happens on the battlefield is you take casualties. They got to be replaced. Now, you can tell me, well, pull the unit out and replace them. You may not have that luxury. What happens during, what are the dynamics during battle? Guys speak up, battlefield commissions. Battalion commander was killed. He was team, 80% of the battalion commanders were medevac captains. They didn't necessarily clean up the SO, they may have taken the SO, this battalion has more experience to move them there. So there is a movement, there is a leadership change. During the fight, a new unit comes in, you may want to spread combat experience. We did that in World War II. You may be forced into a political decision to rotate every year in and out of Vietnam, which means you have a continuous flow in and out. Once you hate it, you're forced to live with it. There is non-violent attrition that goes on. War, every war I've ever studied, is this flow of manpower in and out. cohesion, true cohesion, is institutional cohesion and not unit cohesion. Unit cohesion will happen if you have institutional cohesion. What does institutional cohesion mean? It means when the corporal checks in, that has an MOS, and it's a rank or a grade, and it's assigned there for a particular billet, you have an institutional expectation that he is, has a certain type of billet. We don't have that now. You know the problem with what you're saying now is, a battalion commander can take a battalion and do something fucked up. Because we don't know what he can do. We don't know if he fought into it. We don't know his capability. We don't know that if he possesses the traits of strong intellect, determination, will, and can apply it, and understanding of all this, the knowledge. So there's no institutional delivery, institutional cohesion, institutional meeting of the expectation of the individual. The first thing you've got to do is do that. Make the individual strong, build him up within the institution, live up to the expectation that's presented by his MOS, the grade that he wears, and the fact that manpower is sent to you to assume that assignment. If the institution can deliver on that, no one thing answers that. Not a PME process, you know, not an officer school in 9th Marines, not an application in the field in 4th Marines or whatever. It is a whole institutional-wide ethic or culture that has to be developed and has to be everywhere and has to be demanded on the receiving end and the giving end. We at Quantico are at the giving end. The guys who write orders on people are at the giving end. Out there in the field on the receiving end. Expectations on both sides. Demanding of certain standards on both sides. You know, there are a lot of mechanical things you can do. Force-on-force exercises, institutionalizing some sort of PME process within the units to force people to take part in, forcing the hands of commanders to do certain things. But you can't buy into a piecemeal. You can't say Quantico's doing it, 9th Marines is doing it, you know, Paris Island's doing it, but nobody else is doing it. Or so-and-so's doing it, so-and-so's doing it, and the other guys aren't. There's got to be an institutional acceptance, an institutional ethic that forces this to happen across the board. And the focus has to be on the individual. And he's got to live up to the things we give him, the titles. There's a measure that has to be there, very measured. Things that have to happen and be measured. We published the reading lesson. What exactly does that mean to me? Everybody's going to read those books, right? Wrong. Some people are going to read those books, right? All those people that read the books will get something out of it, right? Wrong. Some people will get different degrees of things out of it, right? And what should they get out of it? What should they do with what they get out? How do they apply it? I mean, we put something out there, we start, but where is it? Where does that probe go? What is the probing for? I don't know the answer. I mean, I can't create the vision. I mean, the vision's already created by Concon. I can't design the implementation. You know, it's got to come from every aspect, every function of the institution. You know, every organization within the institution has got to pervade the institution, and I'm not sure how you do that, how you generate the answer. You can be, obviously, an evangelist and run around and scream and yell from the platform and entertain and hope somebody buys into it, but are anxious to get to their Fox lunch in about a couple hours, you know? So I don't know if that's going to help. General? Is that it?
You want to go to sleep? Go to sleep. Go to sleep here. Yep, I'm sure. I'm sure. Go to sleep. Go drink beer. Maybe it's got to all the questions are over. You guys are up.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.